Support for the Takeaways podcast comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are like a personal trainer for your brain, improving your performance with the science of neuroplasticity, but in a way that just feels like games. Start training today at Lumosity.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry with special coverage all this hour of the developing story in Boston. We are here at the studios of WGBH Boston Public Radio following the manhunt for the remaining suspect in the Marathon bombings. Thanks so much for listening to all of you all across the country. 19-year-old Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, armed and extremely dangerous, brother of Tamerlane Tsarnaev, killed overnight in a shootout with authorities in the suburban community of Watertown. More about that a little later, including the death of a police officer on the MIT campus that also happened overnight. These two Chechen brothers who have lived in the Boston area for perhaps as long as a decade, what motivated them to carry out the Marathon bombings? The desperate mission of law enforcement, we're following that, to capture this suspect still at large, alive. All the latest. We will be breaking away live here to briefings and statements that we expect might happen over the next hour as this story develops. But we begin noting just how the events of this week have made this diverse but sometimes accused of being provincial New England community of Boston, Massachusetts, a world stage where images of martial law, curfews, lockdowns, possible sectarian violence, terrorist bombings, checkpoints, and a profound military presence are all part of this week. No one has felt that more profoundly than Charlie Sennett, executive editor of Global Post, longtime foreign correspondent, and longtime reporter here in the Boston area. Charlie, your feelings and thoughts, and welcome to the program.
Thanks, John. This is the most extraordinary week in my time in Boston. Certainly since 9/11. Remember the flights left from Boston. And then that was certainly a wild sequence of events as well. But I think, how do you deal with this? I guess I've covered so many bombings all over the world. I'm sad to say I've covered them, in Jerusalem. I've covered them in London, in Madrid, in Baghdad, in Kabul. It's just so fundamentally different on a very personal and human level when it's your hometown. This is where I grew up. This is where I'm from. And there's something very profound about going through all of this ritual, almost like choreography of covering the story as I've covered it in so many cities and now covering it here in Boston. It probably shouldn't be different. It's still just people being killed, an incredible act of violence, senseless violence. But I have to say it's different.
And the sense of a whole society, a whole community really under siege as the response transpires all day today. These are familiar images to you as a foreign correspondent, having covered dozens of bombings around the world, and yet because it is your community, it's completely different from all of those stories you've covered.
That's right. I mean, what this reminds me of is, when the Madrid bombings happened, for example, we went deep inside the sort of working class neighborhood of Madrid where the North African immigrants lived, and we had to get inside the head of those Moroccan immigrants who turned out to be the ones carrying the backpacks on the trains. Or in London, when the London bombings happened, 7/7/2005, if I'm remembering correctly, we had to go out to Leeds and we had to get inside a second generation Pakistani community to understand their alienation and figure that out. And the truth is that in so many places where these bombings happened, the same questions are asked. The investigators follow a parallel course. They need to figure out what motivates these young men to suddenly resort to violence. And we all are in pursuit of trying to understand how this happened. And, the truth is, you get there, you can figure out the pieces and the shards, but it comes down to this strange set of events in someone's life that they suddenly become violent. And I still don't think we understand this, or maybe we never will, but the tiny pieces of the puzzle of who these brothers were, the disaffection of their lives, the disruption of their childhood, when they were just really kids and they moved, from Chechnya to Kazakhstan to the United States, their lives completely disrupted. They moved to Cambridge. They go to high school. One of them does better than the other, apparently. The younger brother was very well adjusted. The older brother, Tamerlane, it turns out he was very alienated and very angry at America and about America, posted at one point on Facebook that he doesn't understand America. So I think the dynamic between these brothers is very important.
Well, and the mission, regardless of how difficult it is to get inside the heads of these brothers, is exactly our mission today. Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, named after possibly the leader of Chechnya, Dzhokhar Dudayev. So he carries with him as a namesake the politics of the place where he was born. And, of course, Tamerlane Tsarnaev, who is no longer with us, named for one of the most vicious conquerors in Central Asia in the 14th century. Anne Speckhard joins us now, author of Talking to Terrorists, professor of psychiatry, has studied Chechens intensively around the world. Anne, do you have any insights here as we begin this task of trying to figure out what might have motivated these young men?
Well, hi, John. I think that the thing to keep in mind here, if we're dealing with Chechen young men that immigrated here, that they probably did come with terrible traumas on their souls. It sounds to me like they came as maybe 9 to 15-year-olds, and so they would have memory of where they lived before. And I've heard some reports that they were living in Kyrgyzstan, some that they were living in Dagestan. But all the same, they would have heard and probably lived some of the stories of the wars of independence in Chechnya. And the Russians were very heavy-handed there. Many people were tortured. People disappeared. Some of the boys that were involved in the, men that were involved in the Beslan attacks as boys had witnessed the rapes of their family members. So we've seen before Chechens become involved in terrorism motivated because of traumas and because they wanted revenge. In this case, with these kids striking out at Americans, I would say that their traumas, if this is the scenario, if this is true, that would have made them vulnerable to falling prey to a militant jihadi ideology, to make them identify with the traumas in other places, to buy this line, the narrative of Muslims are under attack, and therefore we should rise up and strike back, which is what al-Qaeda is trying to sell to American Muslims right now.
Speculation there, but speculation definitely grounded in history, contemporary history. That's Anne Speckhard, author of Talking to Terrorists, a professor of psychiatry who has studied Chechens intensively. Anne, thanks so much.
You're welcome, John.
Charlie Sennett, some final thoughts.
Just you know, that Boston's a very resilient town. It's already shown that it can live through this. But now it's going to have to process two of its own, two people who are immigrants but who lived here and were part of the community, and we're going to have this search for trying to understand what motivated them. And we have a long way to go and many questions.
A long way to go, but many windows. We'll be exploring, trying to peer through some of those windows to understand the motives of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, to understand the motives of Tamerlane Tsarnaev, and to fully understand the impact of all of this on the community of Boston and the surrounding areas. Charlie Sennett, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
So we've been covering this story from Boston all day today, and let's give you a feel now for just how much this community, every person in this community, has been directly affected by what's going on. As Charlie Sennett just said, from the sounds of law enforcement at checkpoints and barricades around the city.
You might want to get your crews out of there.
What's the location?
Norfolk Street in Cambridge. We are shutting the street down.
Is he there?
We don't know if he's there. It's a possibility that the suspect is there. We don't know for sure.
Our number one priority right now is with these neighborhoods here in Watertown and making them safe and finding this individual. That's what we're committed to. We need more time. We're making significant progress up there, but it may take hours to do this.
We've heard from people in their homes with the doors locked, literally heeding the call to stay off the streets.
I'm completely freaked out.
People are very scared and in shock.
And it's a ghost town over by where I am.
It's certainly one of those nights that you don't get any sleep.
We've heard frantic accounts of bombs and gunfire in quiet neighborhoods overnight as the chase was on.
I heard a loud boom and then a rapid succession of pop, pop, pop.
During the course of that pursuit, several explosive devices were discharged from the car at the police officers.
We were still going toward it, and then residents from the windows, they shouted, "Hey, it's gunfire. Don't go that way."
And perhaps strangest of all, as the identity of these two Chechen brothers became known from fuzzy video footage yesterday released by law enforcement, became sharp pictures of young men who have been living in the Boston area apparently for as long as a decade. Family members of the Tsarnaev brothers spoke. There was an uncle in Maryland.
Those who are able to make this atrocity are only losers. That's what I say.
An aunt in Toronto, Canada also spoke today. And here from Cambridge, Massachusetts, across the street from the apartment where the Tsarnaev brothers lived, an auto mechanic who encountered Jokhar when he picked up his car on Tuesday, the day after the bombings.
You know, I removed the tail lights out of the car and he said, I don't care. I need the car right now. And I noticed he was biting his nails in the, you know, very shaky. I thought he was on drugs, to be honest with you. You know what I mean? I see a lot of kids that take pills and, you know, he was biting his nails like he wanted to eat his fingers.
And we're going to leave you in this segment with the voice of someone who was perhaps one of the last people to see, or at least hear, Jokhar Tsarnaev as he sped away in a carjacked SUV early this morning on the streets of Watertown, Massachusetts. He sped away to where he is now still at large. Here's Brendan Carroll of Watertown.
I got home from work, and I don't really know exactly what time it was, but I noticed in the coverage that there were a lot of cars tearing off from MGH and MIT, and about 4 minutes later, my roommates and I started to hear rapid succession of gunfire not too far from our house. So, like a fool, I went outside to kind of stand on the porch and see if I could get a better eye on things, which certainly is not smart. But I heard a rapid succession of gunfire, two pretty good explosions, and at that point, a couple of my neighbors were walking down the street, and I informed them that, yes, that is gunshots, that's not fireworks, you should probably take shelter on my porch. Once they actually joined me on the porch, that was when the third really big explosion went off. And at that point, the gunfire started to be much, much closer to us. And literally, I heard the police screaming at somebody at the top of my street. And then an enormous exchange of gunfire. At one point, the police were screaming. I couldn't really ascertain what they were saying, but a black SUV ended up tearing down my street, and I was literally on the ground with my neighbors kind of just keeping our heads down, so we couldn't get a good look at the SUV. I'm not sure if it was a Mercedes or not, but it certainly sounds like it fits the description of the suspect's vehicle.
Was this vehicle being chased and shot at in the middle of your neighborhood?
It appears as though it was being shot at from the top of my street down my street. Once the vehicle turned, I don't know which way it turned, because I was, again, on the ground. Once the vehicle turned, the shooting stopped. At that point, one of the neighbors tried to cross the street and alerted the attention of the authorities. And immediately we all had guns drawn on us and were questioned as to who we are, where we live. It's interesting that they immediately cleared us with the simple fact that we gave our names and where our addresses were. I was on my porch. I said, this is where I live. And they immediately kept going down the street. So it did appear as though they knew exactly who they were looking for.
And they are still looking. The voice there of Brendan Carroll, eyewitness to the standoff between the police and the suspects in the Marathon bombings last night. A standoff that left one of the suspects dead and has become the manhunt that is still unfolding right now. You're listening to special coverage on The Takeaway of the manhunt in the Boston area to find the last remaining suspect in the Marathon bombings. Stay with us. Live on a remarkable day in Boston, Massachusetts, here in the studios of WGBH Boston Public Radio. We are all struggling to grasp what has happened here. Is this an act of ideologically motivated nationalists? Think about it. But these brothers, Tamerlane Tsarnaev, now dead, and brother Jokhar Tsarnaev, still at large, lived in the U.S. long enough for this to be, on some level, considered an incident of homegrown terrorism. Homegrown violence, although with a radically different context than we saw in the Oklahoma City bombing with militia bomber Timothy McVeigh. This is perhaps a scenario of violence unimagined in America until this day. It is known that these boys grew up in a time of violence in their native land. We've already discussed that, repression by Russian authorities. But what could have happened during their time in the United States? Two windows now. Joining us, Larry Aronson, a retired social studies teacher at Cambridge Latin School, where Boston bombing suspect Jokhar Tsarnaev went to high school. He joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Larry, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you.
And can you give us any sense of, first of all, your contact with Jokhar Tsarnaev and any sense of what might have led him to this?
I don't know. I am a retired teacher since 2007, but I've been a photographer at the school and very involved in many school activities and covering many school activities. and volunteering in many student activities. So I'm around there all the time. And I took lots of pictures of Jahar, as we called him, the youngest of the brothers, the two brothers, as a wrestler, and just as an all-around student. And it turns out he lived right two houses away from my condo, right? So, which I discovered sometime last year. We had a couple of interactions. But in all and as I've been saying this over and over again, you know, this, I'm the guy that you go to after the perpetrator has been found, and you go ask people, give us a little background, and I'm the one that says, and I, with all my heart, I believe this to be true. There's nothing that I know about this kid that would explain any of this behavior. He couldn't have been more outgoing, sociable, reliable, dependable, good student, honor student. I think he had got some financial aid to go to engineering school. There's just nothing about him, a bitterness or detachment or anything, a disassociation that would indicate any of this. You know, he was involved with, you know, with wrestling and with just student life and happy and active participant. And I did have a conversation with him about when I tried to understand his name and where he was from and as a history teacher. But he said, Chechnya, of course. I inquired about, you know, what's his narrative? What's your narrative? Do you remember? He shared very little. He remembered very little, you know. But what he emphasized to me every time we talked was that, you know, it's a new world. It's a new life. I'm so grateful to be here. I'm so thankful to be here, you know. And he was just a very active participant in, you know, teen life at the high school. There was nothing whatsoever. And even last night, as I've told everybody, as the optics of this became clearer and clearer, and his face became more recognizable at about 4 o'clock in the morning, 4:30, I said, "My God, that looks like Darhar." I don't even know how to pronounce his name. I never knew how to pronounce his name. I said, "There's no way it could be him. There's just no way it could be him." And the last thing I'm going to go do is, you know, try to, this wonderful kid who I care about, you know, put all the police chasing him like they chased the Saudi kid, you know, who ran away with, you know, with pants on fire or whatever, and went to his house in Revere and did all this kind of stuff. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to me. None of it makes any sense to me. And
well, those impressions, Larry, certainly adding to our sense of vulnerability and mystery about all of this. Larry Aronson, a retired social studies teacher at Cambridge Ringe and Latin School, where Boston bomber Dzhokhar Tsarnaev went to high school. And now, what about Tamerlane Tsarnaev, who is dead, killed in the shooting overnight? Joining us now with insights there, Anna Sale, reporter for WNYC Radio. Welcome, Anna.
Hi, John.
So we understand that Tamerlane had a son, and the mother of that son had a roommate who you've managed to contact and speak with to talk about what has transpired. Tell us about it.
Well, here's what I know. I know that I spoke to a woman who said her freshman roommate at Suffolk University dated Tamerlane. And the last time they spoke in 2011, her roommate told her that she'd had a daughter with Tamerlane, they'd gotten married at City Hall, and that she was considering changing her name to a Russian or Muslim name. So I'm not sure if this is the 3-year-old daughter that has been reported elsewhere, but this roommate said that her former roommate, who they've lost touch, she tries to reach her now and she gets a full voicemail, but she had a relationship with Tamerlane. And she describes him as the kind of guy you don't want your friend dating. She doesn't describe him as reclusive or alienated from American society. They met them. They called them the group of Russians. They were freshmen. They were in Boston. They met these guys, and Tamerlane would take them out to bars, to the Underbar in Boston. He had a nice car. He would buy them drinks. He would pay for things. And her roommate started dating him. But she did describe him as an intense guy. She said he was wicked intense. She described him as having this air of power among his group of friends. He was the one in control. He was charismatic but controlling, she described. And eventually, not the kind of guy she wanted to be hanging out with. She stops hanging out with the group of Russians. Her roommate continues dating him, and they grow apart.
And again, we don't know what contact they may have had, but you are referring to reports from the neighborhood, Norfolk Street in Cambridge, where the Tsarnaev brothers reportedly lived and possibly lived or had some contact with for as much as a decade, that there were also reports of a woman and a 3-year-old child there. Again, unconfirmed if that's connected to this particular report here.
Just one more thing to note, John. What was interesting, the woman told me she never heard Tamerlane talk about foreign policy or talk about religion. It was just, you know, they went out to bars together. So it wasn't clear at all to her that he had any kind of political leanings or anger in that way.
And again, curious pieces to a puzzle. They don't quite fit, but yet they're all a part of our attempt to struggle to explain what might have happened to these young men in the United States for as long as a decade. Tamerlane no longer with us. Anna Sale, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We talked earlier to Larry Aronson, a retired social studies teacher who had contact with Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, who is still at large. You're listening to special coverage of the events unfolding in Boston. This is The Takeaway. The city of Boston and the surrounding area in a lockdown this morning as a manhunt continues for the second suspect in the Marathon bombings, Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, who, with his brother, who died last night in a shootout in Watertown, have apparently lived in the Cambridge area for as long as a decade, at least for the last year. And the MIT campus near where they both lived, those two suspects, is in mourning this morning because of the death in that shootout last night at MIT of Sean Collier, a 26-year-old MIT police officer killed last night. I know the MIT campus very, very well. Certainly the campus is closed. Harvard is closed. All the schools are closed here in Boston. Ryan Borker joins us, an MIT student who ran the marathon on Monday and is in the middle of the lockdown on a campus that is in mourning at this hour. Ryan Borker, your thoughts today and what's the feeling on the MIT campus?
Well, I think the best way to describe it is people are very scared and in shock at the events of what's going on right now. And thankfully, most of the stream that I've seen either on Facebook and Twitter has been people saying that they're okay.
Are you doing okay?
I'm doing fine. I've just been, I'm almost a bystander in this. And it's, I can imagine the people that are out there are seeing this take place right outside of their house. It's been extraordinary to see the citizen journalism going on as well.
And we've had some of those voices on the program already today. Fotini Christia joins us, who we've spoken to many times on this program for very, very different reasons. She's an associate professor of political science at MIT. Fotini, your thoughts as you think about what happened on the MIT campus and just generally in this community?
Things have been really tense, I feel, on the MIT campus. I mean, it's what the Institute has done is extraordinary. I've been receiving SMSs starting at 10:56 last night about the shooting and informing us to stay out. And every half hour since then, giving us updates. And also there was a false alarm on a suspicious package at 4:30 a.m. on 500 Memorial Drive. So they've been very good about making sure we're all safe, spreading the information, and communicating to everyone in the community. So to that regard, I think they're trying to do their best.
Fotini and Ryan, and, you know, interact with each other, if you like, as well. What does it mean that these individuals might have lived in the community for the last decade, just down the street, part of the Cambridge community? Ryan?
I think it speaks to a need for all of us to take care of each other. I think that's the thing that we need to do more of, because these guys, I've seen that they posted on their Facebook page they didn't have American friends, and I don't want to get into the minds of these people, but I think when you see something like this, there's no logic behind it that you can't really understand why they did it or whether you can prevent it. But the only thing you can do is try and create a closer knit community and try and make sure that you take care of any problems, at least nipping some of them in the bud before they start.
Fotini, your thoughts?
I live across the street from Ridge and Latin, the high school that Dzhokhar, the guy who's still at large, attended. And I know it's a very diverse school. A lot of my colleagues send their kids there. According to the news feed, he seems to have been a very good athlete, a wrestler. People from his high school were suggesting that he partied and drank and smoked with them. So my reaction to all this is to also make sure that people don't get stigmatized because of where they come from. I mean, he's Chechen. There's this whole notion of, you know, he's Chechen and Muslim, and that's maybe what's driving this. I mean, we don't know this, and my concern is mostly about what we may presume without knowing. My sense is it could be just an individual thing rather than a community thing.
And that's exactly what we're struggling to find out. Fotini Christia, an associate professor of political science at MIT. We also heard from Ryan Borker, an MIT student who also ran in the marathon on Monday. What could have been the motives of these Chechen brothers? We'll be talking about that in a moment. But let me give you a sense of what it's like to be in this community. I'm looking out a window here at WGBH in Boston, and all day long, streams of law enforcement vehicles have been zooming by. There's a surveillance position literally across the street from this radio station at WGBH Boston Public Radio. And Callie Crossley joins me now, host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley at WGBH, but she is under lockdown at her home. Callie, welcome.
Oh, thanks, John.
How has it been today? What's going on in your neighborhood? And just give me your sense of how everyone in this community, to one extent or another, has been directly affected here.
It's nerve-wracking because it's so eerie to just be sitting in your house, seeing nothing moving outside, and hearing the police sirens, and every now and then a car go screaming by, because I'm not that far from one of the intense surveillance areas where they had that building surrounded for a while. So that's just bizarre and nerve-wracking because it's getting later later in the day, and all I keep thinking is none of us wants to be inside thinking about this guy wandering around in our community and not yet found.
You know, as time goes on here, this begins to remind me of that sense of long-term siege that went on in Washington, D.C., when the shooters were at large and the violence would happen episodically, and that's something that unfolded for a matter of weeks. Any thoughts as to what the feeling will be in the community and in your own household if this takes days, perhaps even weeks, to finally develop?
You know what, John? That's a really good thing to bring up, because I recall that time, and even for those of us who weren't in the area, it felt as though, well, they could have driven here. So you didn't feel quite comfortable, but I know that the folks who were living exactly in the area felt 10 times as uncomfortable, not knowing when something might happen. Well, that's the same feeling you have here, because you don't know quite what to do. I definitely trust the governor in his having said, stay in, and we mean it. So this is, you know, not a joke, and so everybody can't be outside. So you pay attention to that. You see that nobody is outside. You hear the sirens going, and yet you're wondering, what is going on? And what if this goes on through the night into tomorrow, and for goodness sakes, even into, you know, the next day or the next day?
Give us a sense, and you're a veteran political reporter here in Boston, as well as a commentator and host of your own show, Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. What's your assessment of officialdom here in Boston, the mayor, the governor, the law enforcement authorities?
I think they've actually done a very good job. This is not to be compared, but a few months ago when we were in the midst of winter and we had a bad storm, it was Governor Patrick's call, very unpopular call, to say, everybody stay off the roads. Oh, people went crazy. But it turned out to be that was, and when he, by the time he said it, as early as he said it, it saved a lot of, I know, lives, because there were not these great accidents because people were not on the road. And you could see the folks that needed to be on the road, the emergency vehicles, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Same scenario here, because by not having people off the streets, then, you know, they can, if you're wandering around, you're not supposed to be, they have a better shot at figuring out where this guy might be hiding or what the issues could be. So for my money at this point, I think they've done a good job by saying, stay inside, let us do our jobs, and we're only going to give you the critical pieces of information we need to give you right now so that you won't go into an even higher level of panic. Because it's nerve-wracking thinking.
Callie, can I ask you something really quickly before we go? Are your doors locked? Have you gone around and made sure that there's no way to get in your house?
Absolutely. Because I'm, you know, it's very scary.
In lockdown, Callie Crossley, host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley at WGBH, one of the Boston citizens under lockdown, feeling it as these events unfold. A manhunt taking place for the final at-large suspect in the marathon bombings.
Support for the Takeaways podcast comes from Lumosity. Any brain can get better, and Lumosity.com can help. You can give your brain the workout it needs with a training program designed by the neuroscientists at Lumosity.com and used by researchers at Harvard, Berkeley, and Columbia universities. Start training today at Lumosity.com and discover what your brain can do.
We learned overnight, in the midst of violence in Watertown, Massachusetts, that the suspects in the marathon bombings here in Boston were first two young Russian men and then Chechenian men, one of whom was killed in the shootout, Jokhar and Tamerlane Tsarnaev. They came to the United States from Russia, from Chechnya, by way of Dagestan and Kyrgyzstan, areas with a long history of terrorism and conflict. The context into which they find themselves here in the United States perhaps informs how they approached this violent act on Monday. Again, we have no idea of their motives. Joining us now, Stephen Diel, former Russian analyst for the BBC, now freelancer and a consultant, joins us from London. Stephen, I have a number of questions because some other details have come out regarding the biographical details as these boys made it from Dagestan to the United States. Can you first give us a sense of Chechnya's relationship to Russia, and if you're a 19-year-old boy, what you would have experienced growing up in Chechnya?
Indeed. If you were a 19-year-old boy, you were born just before what became known as the First Chechen War. Let's go back a little bit further. In fact, even before Jokhar was born, and certainly when Tamerlan was very small, the Soviet Union split up, of course, officially at the end of 1991. But already in Chechnya, there were people who wanted to split away from the Russian Federation. The Soviet Union was 15 republics, and that split into 15 countries. But there were parts of Russia and Chechnya more than any other which wanted to create its own state. It wanted to be basically an Islamic state. And the Russian authorities handled it rather badly. I mean, there was chaos in Russia in the immediate post-Soviet era anyway. But then in December 1994, under President Yeltsin, they sent in troops to show the Chechens that, you know, we actually are going to keep you as part of our country. There was a very nasty, very bloody war for about a year and a half until in June 1996, much to many people's surprise, the Russian army was actually driven out. And you had clan rule in Chechnya. It's an area. It's not like Russia at all. It's got a different history. It was a part of the Russian Empire from the middle of the 19th century, and it's run and still socially is very different. So you had these clans in control, and they were this. So this is the atmosphere in which these boys are growing up, and it's bloody. It's frightening. It's people disappearing. It's violence, and then there's this their own self-imposed chaos, as it were. There's this clan warfare, and then in 1999, under then Prime Minister Putin, shortly before he became the Russian president for the first time, he found reasons to send the troops back in with the orders, this time don't mess up. And it was brutal. There were atrocities on both sides. It was very, very vicious. But Russia now has Chechnya in a kind of grip. There's a man called Ramzan Kadyrov, who's the head of a clan, who's now the president of Chechnya. And he has worked out a modus vivendi, a way of getting on with the Russian authorities. So it remains part of Russia. But it has been a very, very bloody and very nasty 20 years that Chechnya has experienced.
Stephen Diel, it has come to our attention that this family perhaps was deported or forcibly moved from Dagestan to Kyrgyzstan. Can you describe what the circumstances of that deportation or removal might have been like?
It's very difficult to sort of sit comfortably in a home in London and try and imagine the horrors. I mean, first of all, being in Chechnya, and then Dagestan is right next door. It's also part of the Russian Federation, and it's been badly affected by the violence and the fighting, the terrorism, indeed, in Chechnya. So Dagestan is not a peaceful place either. And then to be sent off to Central Asia, there was no forcible sending of people to Central Asia, because by that time Kyrgyzstan was a separate country. It had been part of the Soviet Union. It wasn't anymore. But presumably, maybe they had relatives or something. I'm just guessing now. But they must have thought that after the horrors they'd experienced in Chechnya and probably continued to experience in Dagestan, that Kyrgyzstan may be better. And then possibly their parents then decided that, you know, this was still, I mean, Kyrgyzstan is a country that's had its own problems since the breakup of the Soviet Union. It's hardly a comfortable place to live. So presumably the parents decided, you know, we need to get somewhere where we can have a safer, calmer existence, which is, if the stories are true, that's when they came to the United States about
Indeed.
10 or so years ago.
So a forcible exile from the circumstances and violence in Dagestan becomes an attempt to get to the United States, a successful attempt. Can you separate, if possible, the Islamic piece here from the political piece here? Commentators on the program have already suggested that these boys, because of this history, might have been vulnerable to, at the very least, feeling isolated and, in a sense, besieged as Muslims, maybe not in the United States, but just in general because of this history. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I'm a long way from Boston, and obviously I'm not experiencing what's going on there, but as with everyone else of sane mind throughout the world, I was horrified by what we saw on our news screens on Monday, and now this development here. So I'm trying to make some sense of it, really, just for myself, and so I'm just sharing that impression with you, and my feeling is, why would Chechen guys do something like this? There's been terrorist attacks in Russia. They've bombed the Moscow metro. They've bombed Moscow's main international airport. That was particularly frightening for me. I wasn't there on that day, but it was a place that I go through quite a lot. And I knew the exact spot where the bomb went off there. Now, that's their way of getting back at Russia after what happened there. There haven't been any attacks by Chechens around the world. They haven't got an argument with anyone else. They've got an argument with Russia. However, what we have seen in the fighting in Chechnya is Islamic extremists coming from outside and fighting there. Now, there is, when we know that people have been influenced by Islamic extremists in the region. So my way of trying to make some sort of sense out of why they've done this is that perhaps they were affected, they were young, they were impressionable, they'd had this terrible life in Chechnya and Dagestan. They must have met along the way, in any case, Islamic extremists. Now, and whether now somehow in their crazy mixed-up way they feel they're doing something for Islamic extremism. That's the only sense I can make of it, because otherwise it makes no sense for Chechens, who have been trying to get sympathy from the rest of the world against Russia, to do anything like this.
Consider, connect the dots. It makes no sense from a high school teacher who knew one of the suspects. It makes no sense from Stephen Diel, speaking with us just there, former Russian analyst for the BBC, longtime observer of Chechnya and its troubled history. Stephen Diel, thanks so much.
Okay.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We're going to leave you this hour with two voices who have been helping us to understand what's going on in this community, a community completely transformed by the events of certainly the last week and especially the last 12 to 18 hours. Philip Martin, WGBH senior investigative reporter right here in the GBH studios. Philip, thanks so much.
John, thank you. It's been an extraordinary week, to say the least. You spoke with a teacher. You spoke with a Chechen expert. I spoke with a young woman today who knew both brothers, and she the younger one she described as shy, the other one she described as a little bit more assertive. Her name is Lily Jane Stavis, a former student at Cambridge Ridgeon in Latin. Here's what she said.
I definitely had some sense of fear towards this person, just in the way he was really intense. And I remember him, I don't remember specifically, I remember him referring or talking about women in a rather aggressive manner, even though he has a wife and he had just had a baby girl. But he drove me home and there wasn't that much conversation in the car ride. I had him drop me off, not at my house, but the street before my house, just because I didn't know him that well and that was the smartest thing to do, I feel like.
Cautious words from Lily James Stavis there, who went to school with Tamerlane. Speaking of Tamerlane, who we spoke with our reporter from WNYC, Anna Sale, about, who has a daughter, a girlfriend, this sense of him being very, very aggressive, confirmed by that tape that you got there, Philip Martin. Let me remind people that also with us is Edgar B. Herwick III, reporter for WGBH Radio, who's on the scene in the neighborhood where the Tsarnaev brothers lived. Edgar, what can you tell us?
I can tell you that we are now as close as we have been at any point today to the actual house. Earlier today, adjacent streets were blocked off to Norfolk Street, which is the residential street in a relatively quiet and what is always described by every neighbor I've talked to here as a safe neighborhood here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The street which they lived on, a residential street which is adjacent to it, a street with shops and bars and restaurants. I'm right now looking down the street at still police activity, though not nearly as intense as it was earlier today. Police and bomb unit folks still in and around the house where the brothers lived. It's quieted down somewhat here as we can now approach the street. The street itself is still blocked off. A lot of neighbors still displaced. They around 8 to 9 o'clock this morning, a lot of neighbors told us, police and other officials knocking on their doors, telling them they needed to evacuate the area. There was some high tension here earlier. There were controlled explosions, which were done by police at some point through the day, which they certainly alerted the crowd here that were coming. It's quieting down somewhat. It's gone from what was a much more hectic environment here earlier in the day to now a quieter, tired neighborhood, but one that is still very much on edge and very much grappling, John, with what has happened here.
And I want both of you to step back for a moment. That's Edgar B. Herwick III, reporter for WGBH Radio, and Philip Martin, a senior investigative reporter for WGBH Radio. We started the week speaking with you, Edgar, about the marathon and your experience of being very near to the bombings. Philip, you immediately started covering that story. To both of you, give us a sense, looking back at this extraordinary week. Edgar?
Well, I would say the fact that this has been less than a week between what happened at the marathon and today seems almost impossible. This has obviously been something that has shaken people here in Boston to their core. It's hard to get your brain around it. You know what the word is, John? The word is dissonance. It's the word that I keep coming back to, that I keep hearing, the dissonance between what the environment was like down there near the finish line, which was one of the most positive environments you can be in, one of the most celebratory environments you can be in on Marathon Monday here near the finish line. People who are completing a lifelong dream, being cheered on by complete strangers, people from all over the world, flags flying from all over the world, people completing this incredible journey to the sound of applause. And for this sort of act of violence to erupt in that environment, it's dissonant. It's hard to get your brain around. And right now, days later, as I stand right here on the street where these two suspects lived, to my right, I see a flag flying at half staff over an auto body shop, which was put down to half staff a few days ago because these guys wanted to show support for what was going on. And steps from this flag flying at half staff, is the house in this very safe, quiet neighborhood where these two very young men lived who, it seems, perpetrated this crime. You can't get your head around it. Dissonance, John, dissonance.
Incredulity. And indeed, Charlie Sennett mentioned this at the beginning of the hour. Patriots Day, one of the most joyful days in Boston. People say the best day to be in Boston from here on out. That will never be the same, Philip.
But beyond the symbolism, I think one thing we have to look at is the investigation itself this week. This was extraordinarily fast. The FBI put together a task force consisting of various agencies, both federal, state, and local. They indicated that they would get to the bottom of this as soon as they could. They enlisted the help of the public. They put the photos out there, a video and a photograph, just yesterday. And we're now at a situation that is indeed tragic, but it may be close to resolution. It's a lot faster than many had expected. And this is a community that needed closure, and it needs closure. And people are still on pins and needles. But the investigation has proceeded faster than many had anticipated.
Well, not only that, but aside from the blip about the arrest a couple of days ago, there has not been the Richard Jewell radically distorted, sort of incorrect moment in this investigation. Things have proceeded in an orderly way with extraordinary cooperation of the community and cooperation, it should be said. And Edgar, you're one of them out there of the media in trying to keep this orderly, to keep panic and emotions to a minimum. And certainly that will be a part of the legacy going forward here, Philip.
Well, no doubt there was some misinformation, but I think you're right. They were very careful not to repeat the lessons of the past, the Richard Jewell case where a man was wrongly accused. And beyond that, there also has been an effort not to turn this into individuals into walking stereotypes, not to malign entire communities, as we've seen in the past, particularly at the conclusion of 9/11.
Well, to both of you, Philip Martin and Edgar B. Herwick III, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, John.
We know that both of you will be on this story all weekend. We're going to leave you now with some of the extraordinary voices of our listeners in support of the people of Boston.
Dear Boston, I'm calling to thank you. Boston, you have not been afraid. You have been brave. You have been the opposite of afraid. And the nation has seen this. And we have looked to you, and you have lifted yourself up and therefore lifted us up as well.
Our phone lines at 877-8-MY-TAKE are open to your thoughts about the people of Boston, the community of Boston, and we've been getting all kinds of responses from around the country.
This is Kim from Rock Hill, South Carolina. Dear Boston, from the beginnings of our nation, we have had sacrifices and losses. None of them have weakened our resolve to overcome. Neither will this. This nation stands with you then, now, and in the future. Stand strong. We have your back.
I'm John Hockenberry. Stay tuned to this public radio station for all the developments as the manhunt continues. Reporting today from the studios of WGBH Boston Public Radio, we thank them for their support. Boston on lockdown. The manhunt continues. Thanks for listening. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.